Chapter 16. What's your problem, man? The stocky bald man in the Houston Astros shirt was rushing furiously toward me, his warehouse of startled workers behind him. He began to scream. What's your problem, man? Paul Wexler, owner of Philikit LLC, yelled as he approached like a schoolyard bully coming for my lunch money. I was bigger than him, so I decided to hold my ground. It might have looked cool if I had not been simultaneously scrambling to pull my N95 respirator over my disheveled head while holding on to my notepad, pen, and phone. I was and remain terrified of being infected with any coronavirus. If one is to risk life and limb in the pursuit of journalism, as many intrepid war correspondents do, it ought to be for a worthwhile cause. This was not in the realm. He got in my face, inches away, eye to eye, no mask, and screamed, "Get the fuck out of here!" I pressed my pen to the notepad to be sure I documented what he'd just said, as is my custom and right. He slapped my notepad and continued to scream, "Get the fuck out of here!" At this point, I felt obligated to inform him of something. "Whatever you choose to do next will end up in the story. Either way," I said. "You decide." What happened next involved a monocular, a speeding Enterprise rental truck, and a warning to public health officials in all 50 U.S. states and territories. My visit to Philikit's warehouse near Houston was a happy accident. It was one of those great minds think alike situations that had me and a colleague looking into the company, at first independently of one another. I had picked Philikit LLC out of our Curious Contractors dataset and ran the usual cross-references because the name just looked funny, and their $10.5 million deal with FEMA was sizable enough to notice. My colleague, Ryan Gabrielson, a Pulitzer Prize winner based in California, had noticed the company for much smarter reasons. They had been hired to supply test tubes and test media, tubes with a liquid solution to preserve samples, that were being distributed nationwide. While I was the idiot chasing idiots chasing masks, Gabrielson had boned up on the science of testing and was therefore immediately skeptical that a company with no footprint in the medical space could provide reliable test kits. He had gone deep to understand why the U.S. testing strategy was so woefully inadequate and plagued with delays, mistakes, and embarrassments. Based on the vague description that some poor contract officer entered into federal purchasing data, Gabrielson figured Philikit's testing supplies were for PCR tests, the gold standard laboratory-run tests that were more accurate and more complicated than the rapid tests. Unlike those quick-turn antigen tests, the PCR tests require more science and greater care. As science goes, it's not all that complicated. Testers stick a long swab up a patient's nose and swirl around for brain boogers, a nasopharyngeal swab in nerd parlance. That sample of cells needs to be inserted into and preserved in some type of media, a test tube with a solution, kept at a certain temperature that can sustain the sample's life, so to speak. The sample can then be investigated for the presence of the virus. If this chain of events works correctly, the tests are usually accurate. None of that cool science stuff can happen, however, if those media aren't done right. Quality control is paramount. So, Philikit LLC had a big and important job. That job was yet more important, given that the CDC had lost several precious weeks because the United States eschewed a well-established test created by the World Health Organization and instead deployed a flawed test that left public and private labs sitting on their hands, blinding us to the rapid spread of the virus during a critical time. It was a fine mess. When historians look back, the failure to launch widespread testing earlier will be an important milestone along our country's winding track to near ruin. And beneath that milestone is a documented trail of stupidity. And at least one angry Astros fan. The lag in testing undercut the three-pronged approach that scientists hoped would slow the spread before we were completely screwed. Test, trace, isolate. Without widespread testing, it's harder to trace the virus's trek from person to person, city to city, state to state. Without the ability to trace, local political leaders and public health officials are left reacting to outbreaks. Moreover, with the virus moving faster than the data needed to make decisions, isolation measures may come too late. Put all that in the context of a global shortage of test tubes and swabs and, so we suspected, you're left with a very desperate federal government that's willing to buy test tubes from whomever. Adding to our concern was the fact that PhilaKit had formed only on May 1, 2020 in the state of Florida. That very same week, on May 6th, FEMA hired the company to supply test tubes with a solution and swabs that were to be distributed to every U.S. state and territory as testing ramped up. The name of the company and the timing of its incorporation suggested that PhilaKit was formed with the intention of profiting from the pandemic. Then there was the owner, Paul Wexler, Astros fan. In business filings, PhilaKit's ownership was listed to a lawyer in St. Petersburg, Florida. But the contact information in the purchasing data linked back to Wexler, who was based in Conroe, Texas, a suburb north of Houston. His life had an uncanny resemblance to that of Jason Cardiff, the guy in California with the dick pills. Wexler was also a telemarketer with a history of fraud allegations. He, too, had been sued by the Federal Trade Commission. He was also, as Gabriel's son would later confirm, the shadow owner of PhilaKit. From 2005 to 2012, Wexler operated a pseudo-debt relief firm that told consumers they could consolidate unsecured debt, such as a big credit card balance, and pay off a new loan with as little as 0% interest, according to court records. This sounds too good to be true offer was marketed online and through telemarketing and robocalling, including to those on the FTC's Do Not Call list. Such a service would have been an enticing offer in this time, as Florida was in many ways the epicenter of the Great Recession's assault on the middle class, and heavy debt loads left many there struggling. As it happens, I was working at a small Florida newspaper near Wexler's company office when it was still in operation and had benefited from a legitimate consolation loan to ease some crippling family debt. These services can be helpful, unless they're a scam. According to a 2012 FTC lawsuit filed against Wexler, the company lured customers with a free consultation and collected customers' bank information in order to repeatedly levy unauthorized charges on those accounts. In the process, the company misrepresented itself as both a credit counseling service and as a nonprofit. When it was neither. When consumers noticed unauthorized charges, the company refused to issue refunds, the FTC alleged. Wexler denied the FTC's 12 charges of fraud and other violations, but settled the case a year later. The settlement barred him from offering debt relief services and imposed a $2.7 million judgment. That publicly accessible judgment, however, did not ban him from becoming a federal contractor with a key role in the country's response to the worst pandemic in a century. Gabrielson called Wexler, who confirmed he owned PhilaKit but rebuffed questions, saying he was too busy to elaborate on how his company got a job so central to the nation's efforts to catch up to the virus. Without much more to go on, we put what we knew about PhilaKit into a broader story that involved five reporters and cataloged how at least 345 first-time federal contractors were awarded some $1.8 billion in pandemic contracts by the Trump administration. And that was just in the first few months of a pandemic that would stretch well into the next year. Several of those bigger contracts were already being canceled for failure to deliver. The trend was becoming clear. The story, the first to quantify this trend, was more smoke than fire, which is fine. We call this priming the pump. in hopes that more details will emerge from reporting what we know. And it worked. A couple of days after the story ran, I got a call from a state public health official who said he had come across the article while Googling the company. He was at his computer to try to make sense of a strange bag of tubes he'd received from FEMA. Right away, he knew they couldn't be legitimate. First, they were made of a fragile sort of plastic he worried was too brittle to survive transport and the testing protocol. More obvious, they were too large to fit into standard lab equipment that he and countless other lab workers across the country use to test for the virus. Baffled, he shared the Filikit tubes with a colleague who recognized what they were. "They're not test tubes at all," the health worker told me. "They're soda bottle preforms. They're the most unusable tubes I've ever seen." He explained that the tubes were tiny plastic blanks that with heat and pressure are blown up to become 2-liter soda bottles found at the grocery store. "What's more," he said, "he had serious doubts that the solution inside the tubes was sterile. He was accustomed to test tubes coming individually and hermetically sealed with specific labels telling him the composition of the solution. These came in big plastic bags, dozens of them just thrown inside. He said state labs and local private labs were already rejecting them, and he decided not to distribute them to testing sites that were desperate to increase capacity. FEMA screwed up, and states were literally left holding the bag. They're going to sit in a warehouse and no one can use them," he explained, saying it set his state back weeks. "We won't be able to do our full plan." This government employee asked to remain anonymous because he had expensive medical bills he couldn't pay if he were fired. He was feeling political pressure from FEMA, where officials knew the tubes were junk and yet continued to urge states to find a use for them. "It was CYA," he said. I took the tip to Gabrielson, and we split up reporting tasks to get to the bottom of it. I worried I might have to travel to Florida, where the company was based, at least on paper. But I happened to be in Texas the very week Gabrielson learned from a source that these non-test tube test tubes were still being processed in a warehouse in the Woodlands, a master-planned suburb south of Conroe and north of Houston. He called and asked if I was dumb enough to go scope it out. He didn't phrase it that way, of course, but in any case, I was. It's pointless to say anything is off the highway in Houston, because the place feels like a slithering snake ball of highways, with people and tacos packed between the violent hiss of motors. But sure enough, the industrial strip mall was just off the highway, and oddly located next to a residential neighborhood. It was quiet that day. I coasted around looking for the place, which wasn't easy to find because the only thing giving away the operation was a low-stock sheet of printer paper taped to a glass door and decorated with a blue and green Clipart volumetric flask, and beneath it the identifier, Filikit. I tried the front door, but it was locked. I pressed my hands and face to the glass to look through, and a woman approached and cracked open the door to ask what I wanted. I told her I was a reporter with ProPublica and was hoping to talk to Mr. Wexler. She said he wasn't around. I gave her my card and asked her to hand it to him. Back in my car, I called Gabrielson, who said his source knew Wexler was in the warehouse. So, I called the number listed on that printer paper taped to the door. The woman I'd spoken with answered, and I asked if she'd oblige my curiosity and provide a tour of the facility. A static echo indicated I was on speakerphone. She was about to politely decline before a man took over and snarled into it. "There's no calls and no interviews," Wexler said. "Don't ever call or be seen again." Click. It kind of hurt my feelings that they wouldn't give me a tour, though I certainly understood why. I had tried the front door, but their less than welcoming response inspired me to try the back one. I waited a few minutes and pulled my car around the back and down the parking lot, where, obscured by a large truck, I could see the rear warehouse door of Filiquet's makeshift office through my front windshield. In my rush to investigate the mask repackaging ring in San Antonio a few days earlier, I had forgotten to pack my digital camera and telescoping lens, which I almost always bring along. More often than not, the real photographers reject my photos anyway, but I had stumbled into the exact ridiculous sort of stakeout situation where I could have used the damn thing. That's when I remembered that about 6 months before, on Christmas 2019, a family friend had given me a monocular as a gag gift, sort of ribbing me for being a meddling investigative reporter. I was so tickled that I promised Aunt Laurie that I'd pack the monocular in my go bag and would find a good use for it one day. And here we were. So, peering through my monocular with 5x zoom, I watched the warehouse's large roll-up door and the rear entry door to the right of it. About a half hour had gone by when, finally, cartoonishly, Wexler peeked his head out of the entry and scanned left and right. He popped back in. A few seconds later, a large enterprise rental truck passed and parked perpendicular to the door in a loading position. The driver went inside, and soon Wexler pulled on the chain that raised the door, and I could see the two talking as workers shuffled around behind them. I set down the monocular, turned on the video feature on my phone, and held it behind my notepad, facing in front of me, so I could capture visuals while also taking notes. In my haste, I accidentally shot the video upside down. I approached from an angle, and as I neared the threshold, the driver and Wexler took notice. "Can we help you?" Wexler said, according to my upside-down video. "Yeah, I'm trying to talk to Mr. Wexler." "You're trespassing," Wexler said, agitated. "Leave." "I'm not on your property," I responded. "You're trespassing," he said again. "Leave." "I'm not on your property," I repeated. Behind him, I could see and catch on video large plastic bins containing plastic tubes in large piles. A worker had been using a snow shovel to load them into the bins from another, larger plastic container. Some workers were wearing masks, some weren't. A forklift beeped in the corner, apparently ready to load the latest shipment into the Enterprise rental truck, which was not refrigerated, as is needed for COVID-19 testing medium. Large industrial fans whipped the hot air around, along with whatever debris was in it. "How are you sterilizing these vials, sir?" I asked. "Are these sterile?" "Fuck you." Wexler pulled the door down as I continued to ask questions. I felt I should confirm that the company went ahead and shipped these particular tubes in that particular truck, and I had more questions, so I lingered a few yards back from the warehouse door, about halfway to my rental car. A minute passed. Wexler emerged from the back entry door and steamed toward me, yelling, "What's your problem, man?" As he was in my face, hitting my notepad, and suggesting he might punch me at any moment, I continued to ask questions. "Fucking liberal media," he said. "All you do is attack, attack, attack." Oddly, he screamed, "Get out of my face." I politely informed him that he was in my face. My face was here first. In this exchange, he accidentally confirmed they were tiny soda bottles, not test tubes. It became clear he would not relent, and our interview, if you could call it that, was not productive. So I turned and walked slowly to my car, with Wexler marching closely behind until finally I got in, backed out, and drove away. I shuddered for a moment to think of how that accidental conflict might have gone if I were a woman. Still, there is a Zen quality to this type of confrontation. The angrier they get and the calmer you stay, the more you're in charge of the conversation. Heated people spill the beans. Wexler had inadvertently added some rich texture to the story, for which I am grateful. I still wanted my confirmation, so I just went around the corner and onto the street and parked along the sidewalk, where I could watch, with my trusty monocular. I observed as he and his workers loaded large shipping crates onto the truck. And as the truck locked up and began to drive away, I could see that Wexler had spotted me again and started to march in my direction, a clipboard in his hand. I put the car in drive and drove to my extended stay hotel. I had seen enough. After this encounter, we heard from three Filikit employees who confirmed what I'd seen and offered some important specifics and, better yet, photographic evidence. They confirmed that workers were using snow shovels to gather up the mini soda bottles from unsanitary surfaces and bins. Next, workers sitting at long tables added a saline solution to each tube, intended to preserve samples for analysis. The liquid, they said, was kept in trays exposed to the open air, which was being moved around by industrial fans. It wasn't even clean, let alone sterile. Teresa Green, a retired science teacher, told us. She had worked at Filikit for just 2 weeks and walked out when she grew frustrated with what she'd witnessed. Before she left, she remembered shaking her head in disbelief, thinking, surely what they're using this for is not like the real official tests for COVID. It was. In the company's first couple weeks of operation, she and others weren't provided face masks, raising concerns that a sick person could be breathing right into saline or tubes that could infect others. More likely, it meant that millions of test kits central to FEMA's response could be contaminated. If workers were spitting microscopic particles into the tubes or the solution, the tests could produce widespread false positives, wreaking havoc on testing efforts nationwide. Green and others said that Wexler and his business partner, the guy driving the Enterprise rental truck, ran the place like a sweatshop. Wexler would come into the warehouse and cuss and scream at everybody, Green said. The bosses were telling us, yeah, we got to have 4 bins by lunch. We got to have 10 bins before you leave at 5 o'clock. Work faster, work faster. My visit to the warehouse sent Wexler into a rage, workers said. He accused some workers of leaking the conditions inside the facility to the media and demanded to see their phones, she said. Wexler and his managers passed out masks and wrapped plastic over the solution trays and the pipettes used to squirt the solution into the tiny soda bottles. He drew the shades down on the doors and windows. At the end of the workday, Paul called everyone together for a big meeting, Green told us. He told everyone that they were not allowed to talk to anyone outside the building, especially the little hippie guy reporter. Look, I couldn't get a haircut at the time, okay? And I'm not little. Paul told the group that the left-wing communists are trying to intervene with Texans and keep them dependent on the government and keep him from making a living, Green said. To round out the story, Gabriel and I hit the phones, calling FEMA, about a dozen state health departments, a contract expert, and laboratory experts. Officials in New York, New Jersey, Texas, and New Mexico confirmed that they had received and couldn't use their lot of the 4 million Filikit tubes that had been sent along by FEMA. Already slow to roll out testing, Texas shelved 140,000 test tubes. At the same time, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases there had risen by more than 30% in just 2 weeks. Some labs rejected the testing media simply because of the solution being used. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration had only validated one solution, a so-called viral transport medium, as reliable enough to keep the RNA in the samples from being contaminated or decaying. But it was in short supply. Filikit was using one of the potential alternatives greenlit by an emergency use authorization, phosphate-buffered saline. There are many potential ways that a testing medium can be screwed up, and Filikit had done just about all of them as the owners hastily turned around junk tubes to collect in just a few weeks, more money than most people will see in their lifetimes. One federal contract expert I spoke with expressed amazement that FEMA not only accepted these suspect test kits, but then also forwarded them to states. Because FEMA accepted them, it was not clear whether Wexler and his associates could be charged with a crime. FEMA hired them for a gig, they produced, and FEMA rubber-stamped the product. Later, after the story ran, the Wall Street Journal published a story that confirmed much of what we had reported, as did others. As the Filicate story gained momentum, in late June, FEMA sent out an advisory to all 50 states to not use the test kits. A FEMA spokeswoman said the agency would work with the FDA and the CDC to analyze the test kits. In response, Democrats in Congress pressed for answers from FEMA and added the Filicate contract to a growing stack of inquiries taken up by the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Response. The Inspector General of Homeland Security launched its own inquiry. FEMA cited that ongoing investigation when it denied ProPublica's request for records through the Freedom of Information Act. Despite all of this, federal purchasing data shows Filicate and Wexler still collected $10,507,988 for unusable test kits. The ordeal wasted gobs of taxpayer money. And more important, it wasted time, when time meant American lives. That's my problem, man.